It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to have Gary Hoyle, a guest that we've had before back, but for something new, which is a kind of a marbling technique that he started using with his oil paintings. And the way he describes it is he first floats a thin layer of dilute oil on water, and stirs the surface and lowers the canvas in to pick up the pattern. And so we're going to talk about that process and what he does and how that kind of works together with everything else that he's been experimenting with. And welcome, Gary. Nice to have you back.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Yeah. And so this, you've reached out to me because you've been experimenting with this technique. Can you explain a little bit of, well, what's your outcome first, and then how do you get there?
Well, I've been doing a lot of landscape painting, and I wanted to try something a little different, and I thought perhaps I might try an old technique, which is pretty well known, and which they call ink floating. And I had been way back, I was a high school teacher. I taught chemistry, and from my old chemistry days, I started thinking about solvents and the use of solvents with oil paints. And I thought, I read up a little bit on marbleizing, and I thought, well, you know, that has got a long history, and that was done in a number of different manners. And I thought, well, as far as oils go, why don't I just dilute some oils and just float them on water, and then take a piece of either paper or canvas and just drop it down on the surface and lift it up, and I would create a print of some kind. I didn't have control of the situation. It was pretty much of a random process. But I found that, some of these things kind of remind me of aerial views. Others remind me of rock formations, various natural features that just appeared randomly that would inspire me to do something creative with them. And so it was from that point, I guess you might say, from the point of boredom, I got very inspired.
That's great. So you go back in then, am I right? You go back into those that you've done and then and work with what is you're presented with, right?
Yeah, exactly. I usually, what I do is I do the prints, which we call prints from the floating ink, and I set them aside, and they have to dry for about a week anyway to before I can do anything with them, and I leave them around the studio, and as I look at them periodically, something inspires me to want to go in and create either quite often aerial views or sometimes rock formations. I can introduce trees on a ledge, for instance, and the pattern on the because of the marbleizing technique, will create features in the rock that I can enhance to make it look more like rock, for instance, or flowing water, or crevices in perhaps an aerial view of a field or a marsh or a mud flat, something like that. Because you know, if you look at photographs of some of these regions, you begin to see features in them, random features that seem to take on that marbleizing effect. It's a fluid sort of effect to it, and it I love dealing with the randomness of nature, we'll say, and all of a sudden you begin to see some feature in there that makes you think of a particular scene or feature in nature that you want to explore. And that's the fun of this kind of technique, is the exploration of the printed work that you have there before you. So
that's just so this is really great, because you're starting with a kind of a chemistry approach, right?
Yep.
To getting there. And then you're going in and you're getting this print, and then that print is making you draw upon your visual history of nature. And that visual history is being manifest by what you think you see, or what it might be that the image is creating for you. And then you elaborate on that.
True. I spent a lot of years as a curator of natural history at the Maine State Museum, where I was also an exhibits artist, and I studied under Fred Scherer, who was preparator and a background painter at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And we spent a lot of time doing very delicate, precise recreations of animals and plants, and I loved what I was doing, but when it came to doing my own paintings, quite often I wanted additional kinds of inspiration. I wanted to create, but I wanted somehow I wanted to explore the abstraction of nature. I mean, you know, we're in a sense, anything that you put on paper or canvas is an abstraction of nature, no matter how detailed it might be. But I wanted to allow the randomness to inspire me, and I felt that by using floating ink, you know, that's like a natural fluid motion that is happening quite randomly. And from that, I could explore visually, or I should say, I could let my mind explore the possibility of what I was looking at. And sometimes it would take me to an aerial view, sometimes it would take me to a rocky feature on the shorelines. I even was working with a friend of mine who is a poet, and he had done some work about Native American folklore, and within that I read one of his poems, and I found that one of the prints that I had already done fit nicely into one of the poems that he had featured about the Native American mythology. And so I worked that up into a background or scene of that was related to the poetry, which featured shells, crabs, other things that fit into that motif that I was working with at the time.
So, wow. So this is really great, because now you're also bringing in other art forms, because you're bringing in, you know, the magic of poetry to be concise and describe something that we see, and you're bringing that to it. When you're looking at these, how long do you sometimes sit and contemplate what's in there? Is it a quick process for some, or does it vary? How long do you let something sit and look at it?
Well, I have images, or I should say prints. I have prints in my studio now that have been there for almost a year, and so it can take anything from a few minutes to a long period of time, depending on the print that I'm looking at. Sometimes it's best for me not to look at the prints for a month, and then something just kind of hits me, and that's when I go for it. For instance, I did a little print a while ago. Well, it's actually quite a while ago, but I pulled it up and I looked at it and I thought, what the heck is this? I mean, it just didn't make any sense to me. And I got away from it for about a month. And then I came back to it and I looked at it and said, oh my God, you know, there it is. It's a rock feature. And it's all I've got to do is to create a little pool there. And all of a sudden it will be a rock with a little puddle of water in the crevice of this bedrock. And so I did that. I really didn't have to do much work to it, and all of a sudden it just came to life. So this is the fun of it, is just letting that abstraction lead you in a certain way, and suddenly you have something that is visual for a lot of people to understand. And most of my career has been communicating with the public. And so I have this sense that I want to express something that people will visually understand.
When you go back in and work, so what medium are you working with when you're doing your own work inside
I have, in the past, I have used a combination. I've done the prints with floating oil, and then I've gone in with even with watercolor at times on paper. That has worked for certain things that I'm trying to create. With the oils, of course, I can overpaint. I can't really do that with a watercolor. With the oils, I have an advantage. I can be transparent. I can be opaque. I can use some of that opacity to eliminate features in the print that don't seem to tie together. Or I can use the transparency of oil to enhance certain features. Many years ago, when I was working at the museum, I had to work with waxes, and I had to create nuts, fruits, many different objects that required an understanding of transparency and opacity. And so I had to mix oil colors with waxes to achieve different effects, different transparencies, different opacities that would look like the real, let's say, fruit in this case. And so I was familiar with that. And so I used that idea in my paintings. And so primarily now I use just oil to brush over the prints that I do. That's why I like to leave at least a week for the prints to dry before I introduce my oil color, because I can end up picking up and smudging some of the prints. So I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So, wow. So I'm thinking about this whole thing, and then I'm thinking of the chemistry of this, and back at the very start of it. So you're using oil paints. Do you ever use just inks, oil-based inks with it?
I don't do that. No, my mentor, who, you know, as I said earlier, was a background painter. He always used oils. And so, I followed his lead, in a lot of this. And, so I've pretty much stuck to the traditional, oil paints.
So you've got a tray or a pan, right? That you put the water's in. Then,
I've done some pretty good sized work too. I mean,
yeah, I was going to say, how big are these things?
Yeah, well, I've got a triptych that each panel is 2 feet by 4 feet.
Oh my God! So,
yeah, so in some cases, it's easy to do in this regard. If you take a polyethylene plastic, you know, sheet plastic, a roll of it, and then take plywood and use some 2x4s to frame in the plywood, then you should put the sheet of plastic, just lay that into that little depression, then take a hose and fill it with water. You know, I do this outdoors. I don't want to do it in the house. Then you get a sizable surface that you can use, and you don't need much floating ink. The diluted oil paint, if you use too much of it, then you just create a mess. But if you just use just dribble a few drops in there and just stir it around, and then drop your canvas down, then you'll pick up a print. You get a pull it back up. I have to leave it. If I don't like what I'm getting, if there's no inspiration there, then I can always go back and print over that. Sometimes a double print actually works to my advantage.
Wow. So you let it dry and then come back in and do it again.
Yeah. And so, you know, other times it just doesn't work at all. So,
I'm trying to get a sense. So do you out of the tube, do you dribble the paint into it?
No, I've got to dilute the paint. And so okay. I use quite often I'll just use turpentine and okay. Thin the paint down and put a few drops of paint on the surface. I like to use earth colors to do that. My mentor always told me, he said, hardly ever should you use black, you know, in your painting. And I could understand why, especially in landscape painting. It's you really don't see black in the landscape. So you know, if you really look hard within the field of a landscape, you see color. Even the blacks are not really black. They're black is the absence of color anyway, but within nature, color's all around you. It's just that may be muted, but it's there. So you have to train your eye. I learned this very early on when I started working at the museum, because I remember Fred telling me, look for the red in the green of the leaf. And I, you know, I thought, you know, where's the red in the in the green of the leaf? So I took green paint and I painted on a piece of mat board, and we went out in nature, and sure enough, I mean, once I got that green next to a leaf, I mean, the red jumped right out at me. So
I love that, because, you know, we do talk, I learned in art school that, you know, especially in nature painting, and landscape's a part of that, but that you don't use black, because really it's not black. It's a lack of illumination. So it's really the shadow. So if that was a royal blue and it gets back in shadow, it appears black to us, to our eye, but it's really not. It's still that blue color. So I think you're right. I mean, and that's true with white too. I don't think there's things that are pure white in nature either. There's always some sort of color within it. I love this idea that you took the paper, the matte paper, and you took that green out into nature, and then you actually used that as a way of seeing something that you couldn't see.
Fred's history, he worked under, for a while, he worked under James Perry Wilson. If you ever look Wilson up, you'll find that he is considered the top diorama background painter in the world. And he used to go out and paint with Wilson. And when they would go out, Wilson was always adamant that he look for the color in those dark areas. And wherever you see color, you know, because you mentioned the violet, for instance, you also find its complement very close by, and sometimes mixed in with it too. So I don't know. Studying color in nature is just fascinating. It really is.
Well, I encourage people that are in our audience to go out and do what you just did. Just put a little color on something, or even take a color swatch from the, you know, the Home Depot or whatever. Take your color swatches out and compare them in nature and see what you see when you're holding it side by side. I think that I've never heard that of that done being done, and that is a brilliant idea.
Well, I also used to, for about 20 years, I taught adults art, you know, and one of the things that I did was, first we do drawing, and then the second semester we would do color, and usually I'd use watercolors for that. But once they get through the drawing phase, then I would have them do a drawing, a portrait, and I wanted them to bring in a photograph, either from a magazine, didn't matter, of something with strong highlights and dark areas. And so I would have them break up that portrait into highlights and then shadow areas. And then I would have them create a very strong distinction between these. In other words, you know, you put your shadows in very dark, and you leave the highlights white, and then the rest of it would be gray. So it you know, you had this kind of posterization of people's faces. After that, then I had them use yellow on the highlight, blue on the shadow areas, and red would be everywhere else. Once they got done, they had a very strange poetry. But what it showed is how the feeling of distance with color, you get this different feeling with these colors, these primary colors. And it really allowed people to really experience the power of each one of those colors, the feeling of color recession in the blue, the feeling of expansion in the yellow, and then you've got the red in there somewhere, and it created this effect that instantaneously people could understand.
Yeah, and yet you're talking about that kind of thing as you get some distance on things, right? There's the blending, and, the pointillists figured that out, and yeah. Others. And so that's what you were having your students do a little bit. I mean, it's exaggerated up close, but as you back away, you start to begin, you're right, it begins to resolve into something that's more natural than you'd think it would be.
Well, plus you get an appreciation of the power of color as far as size and distance of objects go too. So if you break it down to primary colors and work with the primary colors for a while, and you really get an appreciation of what color can do, and then you can go into the subtleties of complementary colors. And in your tertiary color, for instance, to modulate that.
This is great, Gary. We've been talking to Gary Hoyle, artist, and I know has science background, a museum curator and author. Please join us for more conversations after this break.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest, Gary Hoyle, who's created a series of work that he calls Oogle Earth, like in Google Earth, but Oogle Earth, which I love. And it's aerial views that he creates. And he has another one that's on Oogle Landscapes, where they're landscape views. And he was explaining earlier in our show the ways in which he uses large, really kinds of beds of water to be able to float this oil in. And I'm really curious, Gary. So the oil you dilute some, I mean, the oil paint, and you dilute it some, but what is it about it that makes it, I know everybody thinks oil floats on water, but what is it about it that makes it not combine with the water? Why does it stay separate?
All organic solvents do not mix with, well, there are some that do mix with water, but very few of them do. Acetone will mix with water, for instance, and alcohols will mix with water. But there are other insoluble liquids. Gasoline is a good example. I mean, if you look at where gasoline has been spilled in a puddle of water, which is, I think just about everyone has seen, you see that shiny, wonderful, different bands of color that are floating on there, and they take up a very organic feel to them, and that I think probably was what inspired me to begin to look into solvents and see what I could do. I had read a book on floating ink and marbleizing, and I I read about the process, and some of the process actually can be directed. In other words, you can get the old book inside the book. Just as you open up the some of these old books, you'll see marbleized pages. Mm-hmm. And there in most of these marbleized pages, the person that did the work had some control over that, but it also was a process that took quite a bit of discipline. And I thought, well, just floating on water, gasoline floating on water, that's pretty, for me, it was a kind of inspirational thing. So I thought, well, why not try just taking a solvent that does not mix with water, and use some color and see what happens on its own. Can I get this kind of gasoline pattern? And sure enough, I did. I mean, I didn't get the rainbow effect, but I did get the visual impact of a substance floating on water. From that, it's easy. From that, it's easy to look at some of these images on like Google Earth or some of these other places on Facebook or other locations, even some books that have these features, and you look at the Earth from a distance, a certain distance, the landscape from a distance, and you begin to see these abstract patterns, and they kind of take on this fluid quality, and so I thought, if I try this, maybe I could get an aerial landscape feature. And I had been an artist in residence at the Climate Change Institute for a number of years, and I had seen certain features that I thought were interesting from a climatological viewpoint. For instance, looking at salt marshes and some of the destruction that's happening to salt marshes because of the rising sea levels. And I thought, some of these patterns look very much like that gasoline on water effect. And so I started doing some of these aerial paintings, and they were fun. They were a lot of fun, and I learned a lot from that too.
So once you, and you talked about this earlier, but once you delete it, you get the oil paint, then you get it and drip it into there in certain ways onto the water, and then you move it around. What are you using to move it around? A palette knife? What do you use to move it?
Oh, just a stick.
Yeah. Okay.
Nothing.
And it's wherever you're moving it, not only to create this positive and negative space, but you're also moving it to wherever your eye is feeling at that moment that it needs to move, right?
Yeah, and of course, you don't have a great deal of control over this. What you can do is you can see a pattern on the water. And so you look for a particular pattern that intrigues you, and then you just carefully drop the canvas over the surface and then pull it back up, and you have yourself a print. And as I said before, I usually wait for that at least a week before I interject my own color with a brush.
And so how do you keep that from running when you come back up? Is it a process pretty quickly that you have to flip it back flat?
So in some instances, I've actually left the print face down and secured it with the boards on the side so that it doesn't touch anything. In that instance, sometimes I will see spherical marks, which indicate to me this is where the water dripped from the painting.
Really?
And other times I will turn the print over, as you were talking about, and I will see these drip marks. And but I don't touch them. I leave them until later, because I can sometimes I find that I can use those features. Some of these things look like streams or roads or, you know, other features of the landscape. So I do not attempt to remove them, because later on, I mean, I can remove them with brush if necessary. So I try to keep those features.
So that's one of the magics then of oil too, right? Because you can go back in, can you rehydrate oil, right, on the paper, so you can actually go back in and absorb some of it or move it?
Yes, yes, indeed. And of course, you know, depending on your oil, your opacity or transparency, you know, you can work those effects in. I did years ago. Excuse me. I did a large oil painting from one of these prints that for a long time I couldn't figure out how I was going to handle that. And there was a feature that went through the print that was water that had just, you know, had dripped off the canvas, and it had just run down the side of the canvas. And then I realized that, hey, you know, this kind of looks like a stream or a river or something like that. And within a broad context of mountains and other features. And so I ended up carrying that idea through, and it was a painting that seemed to work. So I'm pretty happy with it.
Is there a way, have you ever thought of, you were saying you leave that paper in there. Have you thought about having a way, a drain or something? You could drain the water away and let it dry in that position. Have you thought about doing that?
Well, first of all, there's not much water on the canvas when you lift it up.
Okay.
The other thing is that, you know, I'm usually outdoors doing this.
Oh.
So all I have to do is just elevate a board on one side, and I can just let that water drain off
away without hitting the canvas. Yeah.
You know, what little water there is on the canvas. So
that's just, it's phenomenal. And the scale that you're working in. So how do you move a paper that's 2 feet by 4 feet? That's just not easy.
You know, I used canvas that's already been attached to a frame. So
okay.
It's easy for me to just lift up. So I can just use the back of the canvas. I can hold on to those supports and dip those over the water to pick up the print, and then I can just lift that up, and it's pretty easy to do. Then if I want an effect where I have these perhaps parallel lines, I can always elevate one side of the canvas so that the water has a tendency to just drain off in one direction.
So when I'm thinking then about it comes out, you see it, and then it has to dry. Do you see sometimes totally different things after it's dried than you did when it was first coming out? So when you pull it out and you first have it and you set it to then to dry, but before it dries, are you seeing a different image than you see later after it dries? Or with oil, does that not really matter? Is that still kind of the same?
Well, for instance, an example, I mentioned that triptych early on that was 2 feet by 4 feet each panel.
Right.
And I did not intend to create a triptych. I was doing a series. And so I did these three panels and I set them in the shade to dry. And I walked around them and I looked at them and I said, Jesus, these panels, each one of these seems to have a relationship to the other. And so I began to move them around and I found that I had a design already set up that I could use. And then it was a question of, well, how do I use this? In this case, it was an aerial view that that worked for me. So you learn as you go, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I get inspired by a number of different things. As I pointed out, I had worked with a poet. Actually, he lives next door, actually, and teaches in New York State through online. And at a college there, but anyway, I had this painting or this print that didn't speak to me very well. It just didn't work. So I reprinted it again. So I have a print over a print, and now I really messed up, you know. I mean, I said, how the heck am I going to use that thing? Because it's got a big blob in one part of the canvas. And then I get these interesting lines and negative spaces. How am I possibly going to use this? Then I read his poem and I realized that, geez, you know, this poem relates to this print in an odd way. And I could begin to see features of an Indian woman who was being dispersed into nature. She was, her being, her essence was flowing back into nature. And I began to see features of this Indian woman and the fabric material that she had been wearing and how this all dispersed back into nature, and the painting worked. So
that's just really this idea that you're looking, but you've been looking for years, so you've got it's so I guess what I would suggest to anybody that's listening is the idea that you're talking about, which is you continue to look, you continue to see, you're curious about the world. So you're seeing things all the time. You don't know at the moment if any of those are going to do anything. And that isn't even your intent. You're just curious. But that curiosity then fuels your art because you start seeing things through that lens of what you've seen.
Yeah, that's why I started it, actually, because I was enjoying landscape painting, but then I just felt like I needed to be inspired by something else. And the landscape painting is all nature. When you try to put it down on canvas or paper, is an abstraction. It's an abstraction of nature. It's not nature itself. And so what I craved was an abstraction that would force me to put it into convert this into a visual experience that I could relate to other people.
That's just that I, you know, it's amazing the idea of the way in which it inspired you, the way you got kind of started on this. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further in conversation with others the ideas that we're exploring in today's show. And we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with our guest, Gary Hoyle, about the ways he combines a marbleizing technique with his oil paintings. And Gary, one of the things that I think people do get confused about, and I can see why, and we had talked about that earlier, but is color. And color, I never realized. I saw this incredible demonstration that somebody had done about we talk about color of light being absorbed or reflected. So what we see is whatever is reflected back to us that isn't absorbed. So if we see red in something, it's because everything else has been absorbed, but not the red wavelength that's in there. So when we see that and do it, and so this demonstration, this guy had these little cards that were actually painted in that color. So it would be a red card and it was folded in the middle like you would get as a greeting card. And then he put it on a piece of paper and he lit it, and the shadows that were cast were red or blue or green on white paper. He had white paper below. And I went, oh my gosh, for the first time, right? It's transmitting that back. I mean, it's reflecting that. It's actually reflecting it. And I knew it from a physics viewpoint. I knew it from something else. And so you must see that daily where you've got all these colors, you've got them in there, and then there's this kind of certain things just come forward.
It's true. I mean, once you get into color, you can spell the rest of your life absorbing all this information about color. When I used to teach art to adults in this program, I used to love to shut the lights off. We would look outside and we would see the sun going down, and so it started getting dark and it was dusk and this sort of thing. And you had the warmth of light in the room, and you're looking outside and you see this violet tone, coming on, and strong dark violet. And so I was talking about color relationships, the warm light in the room. And so we shut the light off, and suddenly the violet disappears. You look outside and that violet disappears. So it's that constant relationship of color that we're not sensitive to it because it's around us all the time. So we just learn to ignore it. But when we begin to really discover it, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And we suffer from also having language problems to describe color. There's a host, I remember I was always excited when I was a kid to get a box of 64 I think it was, colors in a Crayola box. And because they were, but they had all these names, you know, that somebody was trying to figure out for it. But it's incredibly complicated to give a description of all the possible reds that I might see, which are infinite. But we then, when we try to communicate verbally, we do have a trouble, don't we, with each other? Because if I say red, you see a different red than I see. And so yeah, it's really tough.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's very true. I remember my mentor, Fred, telling me about, you know, how critical their background paintings were at the American Museum of Natural History, and how the glass, which has a greenish tone to it, they had to compensate for the color of the glass. I mean, they were that in tune with color and nature that they could actually, the glass would absorb some of the violet tone. And so they had learned by studying so much color out in nature, they could go in and they could compensate for that green in the glass. And I find that amazing.
Did they have to use, I'm curious, did they have to use a piece of green glass in front of them when they were painting to help do that?
I think I very likely they did.
Yeah, you know, painting behind it on the back side, because it's hard to imagine trying to do it with just visually. But exactly. That, wow. I would never have thought of that, Gary. You know, how many museums have all of us been in? And if the diorama, that era of dioramas where the backgrounds were painted behind, right, inside the glass case.
Exactly.
How many of those were painted? And to be more accurate, I never thought of the adjustment of the distortion of color by the glass. That's fascinating to me.
Well, I think this was the genius of James Perry Wilson. He spent his entire life just studying nature and color.
Yeah, you could just keep going with color. The other thing that I think is interesting about color is what we see in pigments, or what we see reflected, is a different set of colors when we talk about primary colors. So we talk about the red, the blue, and the yellow, which all of us grew up with. But when I'm mixing light, when light's coming together mixed, it's different. It has a whole different set of properties. So when I put a whole bunch of color on a canvas, what I'm seeing reflected is the presence of all color is the black or the darkest. That's there are the dark browns. But in light, it's white when I put all those colors together. And so I think that becomes really confusing to people to imagine when you paint with light, it's different than if you paint with pigment.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, you know, how do you work with your complements? You know, and I think it's important to go out into nature and see exactly what's out there for color, because our minds tell us that, you know, the trees are green, that the bark of the tree is brown, you know, this sort of thing. And unless I'm not trying to say that you've got to go out and paint you know exactly what you see as a color on something. I mean, there's all different ways of painting and different reasons for painting a particular scene or a way of doing it. But if you seriously study color and nature, then I think it really behooves you to do those color swatches, get out there in nature and see basically how far off you are from natural color, because natural color is influenced. You know, we can go up to an object like a leaf. We can see the red in the leaf. But if, let's say, we get a leaf that's 3 feet across, then you start walking away from the leaf. You keep walking away from the leaf, and all of a sudden, you begin to see that the leaf changes color, and the leaf changes color because of the colors around it. Atmospheric perspective, for instance. And the complements that surround that too. It's simple and yet it's complex.
It really rolls back to what I started this with, was, you know, I saw on paper, you know, the reflected color. If you take it out in nature, they're reflecting on each other all the time, right? And so it isn't just that they're a color, but they're reflecting a shadow that is a color. And so that's actually blending with what's actually there. So you're getting this, as you move away, you're getting these shadows that are blendings of what's being reflected. And I think people really forget that that's really happening, because we don't remember that it's actually reflected. It's in that we can have colored, it was amazing to me when I figured out we could have colored shadows on colored shadows. In other words, I could have a blue shadow on a red shadow. And then there was a mixing that happened just from the shadow. And so.
It's true. The complement that you see in a leaf, the red, for instance, as you move away from that leaf, other things that surround it are going to affect that color too. So,
within your eye. I mean, so you're.
Yeah, because you're seeing other colors around you, which can perhaps enhance that green or enhance that red in that leaf. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, it's like, it's like an orchestra, you have a flute playing all on its own, and then other things join in with that, and then you have the presentation of the final orchestra. So when you're doing a scene in nature, it's the same sort of way, they all interact together in some way.
I like your idea there with the orchestra, because if I were to go in there and stand really close to the trombone, that's mostly what I would hear, which was your idea of seeing the leaf from that. But as I back away from the orchestra, I hear less of that. And it's influenced by everything else. I think that is a really great metaphor for what you were talking about. I want to thank you, Gary, for spending the time with us. I hope that all of you will take a look at Gary's work. It's at GaryHoyle.weebly.com, and that'll be on our website as well with us, so you can see his work. And Gary, I hope that we have encouraged some people to go out and start using their eyes and looking and seeing and discovering the magic of what's out in nature. And again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
So until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.